meetings in terms of lawmaking powers. The most famous resolution was passed in 1988. It required all the banks to meet the 8% capital adequacy requirement. This is I discussed with the students before. This is a perfect example how you can use lawmaking power to expand your influence and to help your own firms to defeat firms from other countries, because the Japanese banks were very influential. Japanese banks were very competitive in 1970s and early 1980s. They are about to take over almost the whole world. So you guys are too young, but the older generation might remember that in 1980s the Japanese are buying a lot of American property, right? including the Sony Picture, right? It was an American movie production company, but now Empire State Building. I'm not sure whether that is the one, but the Japanese actually purchased a lot of landmark buildings in the U.S. and in Europe as well. So Japanese banks were very competitive. If you follow the news, over half of the top 10 banks were Japanese banks. They were Japanese banks. American banks and the West and European banks could not resist the competition from the Japanese banks, but the international financial institutions were controlled by the Americans and the Western Europeans. So what they did was they formed this Basel Committee and they passed the first Basel Agreement, asking for capital adequacy of 8%. 8%, and the Japanese banks at that time, their capital adequacy was only 1%, 2%, because Japan has a very special business culture, the network culture, right? You have cross shareholding, and for the Japanese banks, between them, they are not competitors. They are brothers, sisters. They cooperate with each other. When you have a problem, other banks will come to rescue. So you don't need 8% capital adequacy, because 8% capital adequacy means that 80% of your capital cannot be used. Means you need a lot of, if you want to, it tremendously reduces your leverage to do business. So your total assets, 80% must be your own asset. Right? The Japanese banks, only at that time, they enjoy a very high leverage, because for a bank, right, if you have $1 trillion assets, 1% of it is the shareholder's own assets. For the rest, you can borrow from the depositors, from the creditors. But if you need to raise that to 8%, then that means you have to either reduce your total assets, right? Then you make a lot of money. So the Japanese banks could not meet this standard. Then withdraw from the American and European market. This is a perfect example that how you can use this lawmaking power, rulemaking power, discourse power, to help your business. And the Japanese banks left the international market and never come back. If you look at the top 10 banks today, they are mainly American and Chinese banks. American Chinese banks. The top 10 banks, four or five of them are Chinese banks, but state-owned banks, and the rest are American banks. So that's the banking regulator at the international level, and we also have a regulator for not a regulator, very much a standard setting agency and negotiating forum, the CPSS, Committee on Payment, sorry for the repetition, the type of payment and settlement system, and for money laundering we have the Financial Action Task Force, and this is very important. organization, especially for the Americans, because it is also a very important anti-terrorism organization. You need this organization to coordinate international efforts for money laundering purpose, to monitor the money used by the terrorists. So that's the money laundering organization. Securities market, the IOSCO, International Organization of Securities Commissions, and the stock exchange. We have the the World Federation of Exchanges, Insurance, you have the IAIS, and there's also a joint forum for the international financial regulators. So the regulators come together every year to talk, just to talk. And you have auditing committee and accounting regulators. So those are the international institutions in charge of international financial affairs. As you can see, they are quite fragmented. We don't have a supranational authority like your central bank, right? In the U.S., we don't have a supranational authority like the Securities and Exchange Commission, which is very powerful, and its decisions can be enforced. So you don't have this is very much the nature of international law. You don't have an authority above sovereignty states. So that's the... And we will focus on today, what we are going to do today, we will focus on the most influential organization, the International Monetary Fund. We take a look at the IMF as an international organization, looking at International Monetary Fund from the perspective of international law. It is an international governmental organization with legal personality. And it has as members, and it has a governance structure, it has immunities and privileges, so and countries have, member states have agreed to give part of their sovereignty to International Monetary Fund. But still very limited sovereignty. And it operates in a very, very interesting, way. As a nutshell, we can see that the IMF now faces two major problems. The first problem is legitimacy. The emerging powers are underrepresented. The IMF is now controlled by U.S. and European and Western European countries, and the newly China, Brazil, Russia, South Africa. Why I kept saying South Africa because they forgive. South Africa is not that important. they are underrepresented, and that's why they are not willing to participate in a lot of IMF-sponsored activities. And to a large extent, China has actually posed not only a theoretical but a practical threat to the IMF, in the sense that China actually replaced the IMF as the lender of last resort for many developing countries. When they actually can go to IMF, but because the bureaucratic process and because of the conditions imposed. If they go to China, it's much easier for them to get money, especially African countries. If you follow the news, you can, Financial Times, Wall Street Journal, a lot of stories about China expanding its influence in Africa and Latin America. So that's the, the legitimacy is a very, very serious issue. The IMF does not represent all the countries in the world, and another problem is effectiveness. The IMF is very effective. Even the mainstream economist, mainstream international relations scholar would agree that the IMF so far is a failure. It's not a success. since its establishment. It's a failure, unlike the GATT WTO system. Unlike the WTO, WTO has been a success, tremendous success, but the IMF is a failure. The World Bank is also a success to some extent. Well, how do you? Of course, it depends on how do you measure, right? Success. How do you define success? Well, success means you achieve your original goal. The IMF, the World Bank has done that, and the WTO has done that. It has achieved its goal as an organization governing international trade. The IMF is a developmental agency, but the IMF is, unfortunately, a sad story. It's a failure. But it's still very, very important. So we examine those kind of operational details, and we will explain to you in more detail why it's not yet a success. A bit of the history: the IMF was founded in 1994. We discussed this already. It was formally established in 1945. They were 45 nations. There are 45 nations at the Bretton Woods Conference, but eventually only 44 nations joined the IMF. The only country that did not join the IMF, what is it? Does anybody know? The only country, that's almost a common sense, the only country, the other superpower that didn't join the IMF, the Soviet Union, the USSR. So Soviet Union didn't join the IMF. For the Soviet Union, that's of course based on at least in its propaganda, that's because the IMF represents the capitalist class, the bourgeois, those imperialists, and there was actually a very important technical reason, because to join the IMF you have to report disclose a lot of information to the IMF, and the Soviet Union did not want to do it. The Soviet Union didn't join the IMF for this technical reason, because Soviet Union couldn't meet and did not want to meet the disclosure obligations under the IMF articles of agreement. So the purpose of the IMF, those are not empty words. They are very important. If you read between the lines, they are very important words, and that those purposes can explain why policies implemented by the IMF, why the conditions asked by the IMF in its lending package to those countries in financial crisis, why there is a huge conflict between these two. Because the purpose of the IMF can be summarized as one: financial stability. The IMF only wants to even. It is a good purpose, of course, right? The IMF, but the IMF, according to its own mandate, the IMF only wants to maintain financial stability at the expense of anything else. But when a country is in financial crisis, it has a lot of problems. It has social problems. It has political problems, it has the economic problems included. And the prescription given by the IMF was for the purpose of resolving your financial problem only. Right? So for that purpose, you have to close a lot of companies, enterprises. You have to fire a lot of workers. And that actually worsened the social and political problem in the country in crisis. So many governments collapsed after they received the IMF rescue, after they got help from the IMF, because the IMF, this is a very interesting legal issue as well. Because legally, the IMF is required only to maintain financial stability. So all the economic policies required by the IMF, asked by the IMF, urged by the IMF, is to maintain financial stability at the expense of anything else. to override any other objectives. So it's closely related to the purpose of KMF. Its purpose prescribed in its own constituting agreement. So those are not empty words. If you write a paper on this, you better take a look at, read carefully the purposes. In terms of the structure, it has it's a three-tiered organization. You have members represented. You have members represented at the board of governors level, and the second tier is the executive board. And very much like a board of directors in a company, right? You have shareholders, and the shareholders represented at the shareholders meeting, and also you have a board of director, and then you have the CEO. The CEO is the managing director. So the board of governors, theoretically the highest authority, the governors are the finance ministers. And the finance ministers. For some countries, those are central bank governors. And each country is allowed to appoint, each member is allowed to appoint a governor and an alternate in case the governor, normally the deputy, minister of the finance. And that's the council of the ministers, that's the highest authority in the decision making body, and if you follow the financial news, it meet every year. Sometimes most of the meetings are held in Washington D.C. because that's where the IMF and the World Bank are located, and that's also where the federal government, the U.S. federal government, was located. So the so-called, you might have heard a very interesting term called the Washington Consensus. What does that mean to you? In the academic world, there is a debate about, is ongoing debate about the competition between Washington Consensus and the Beijing Consensus. So what does Washington Consensus mean to you? Why is it called the Washington Consensus? Okay, liberalism, economic liberalism, new liberalism, whatever it is. So liberalization-oriented policy. Why is it called the Washington Consensus? Does anyone know? Because it is the policy framework agreed by three institutions. The IMF, the World Bank, and the White House. So if you can get the consensus of these three, then everything is resolved. Yeah. That's something you have to. And such a consensus will be accepted in Brussels by the European Union, and then the rest of the world will just accept it. So that's something called the Washington Consensus. And every year, whenever the IMF and the World Bank meetings are held, you can see a lot of it's a big show every year. It's a lot of demonstrations and protests whenever you have such a meeting. But most of the powers of the Board of Governors are delegated to the Executive Board. The composition of the executive board is very, very interesting. For the board of governors, one country, one membership. Every country is represented. But the executive board only has 24 members, and they make the decision. They make a decision for most important matters. On a daily basis, actually, So who are represented is actually very important here. Who are You have the IMF now has 186 members, and the decision-making body can accommodate only 24 members. Right? So who gets the seat is a very important issue, very important matter. At this stage, the five largest countries, the five countries with the largest quota, I will explain to you very soon what are the quotas. Each country gets one seat, so they could appoint one director. So five directors' position already taken, and the U.S., Japan, Germany, France, and the U.K. And three other countries are allowed to appoint to occupy a seat for various reasons. China, Russia, China for both political and economic reasons, and Russia for obviously for political reasons. And Saudi Arabia. So Saudi Arabia is what's so special about Saudi Arabia? Well, after all, they are defeated by Germany 8-0. What's so special about Saudi Arabia? Well, it's the largest oil-producing country, and it has contributed a lot to the in terms of contribution to the IMF, they call it general accounting resources. It has a huge amount of reserves. So that's Saudi Arabia is also very, very important, and other directors are elected by the members. So the members can, if you look at the composition, for example, the Rwanda, that's the country in turmoil, but it has a seat. Rwanda represents 24 African countries. And Mexico has been the speaker for the Spanish-speaking countries for decades. So for those important powers, the IMF is certainly a power-based organization. It's very much a power-based organization. It, unlike the WTO, WTO practice consensus and plus one country, one vote. Right? So in theory, every vote counts. Every vote counts. But in the IMF, it doesn't work. It doesn't work that way. It depends. depends on the size of your economy. And even the size of your economy does not matter that much. It's also path dependent. The tradition also matters a lot. For example, China is already the second largest economy in the world, but China, we will see the quota shared by China is actually below the five Western countries, and that's why China is not willing to sponsor to endorse a lot of IMF activities.